All right, welcome to the pastor's class this morning. Glad you're here. We just finished, five sessions on essentially kind of the basics of the Lutheran Church. And the overall kind of theme that we're working with right now is mission, is missions. What is that witnessing? What does that mean? There is a lot of controversy, really, about what mission is these days. There is not a lot of agreement in the Christian church worldwide about what the nature of mission should be. And of course, it has what we believe about mission makes a great difference in terms of how we actually operate as individuals and as congregations. And roughly speaking, so for the sake of just kind of clarifying, that there are basically two two ideas about what mission is that the church generally holds. They're not mutually exclusive, but they have become that way in many places. The first definition of mission is evangelical outreach. That is to say, reaching out with the message of the gospel. You know, for God so loved the world that he gave his only son, whoever believes in him will not perish but have everlasting life. That message of the gospel is the essential mission of the church, to make that message known. The other theme that the church sounds is the mission of service. Feed the poor, the hungry, clothe the naked, house those who are destitute and without means, provide assistance and help of all kinds to all kinds of people in whatever circumstances of need they find themselves. This, for many, is the essence of mission. Today, these two thrusts of mission, ironically, have been driven apart to a large degree, so that when you think now, for example, of mission as social service, social welfare, mission as caring for the environment, caring for the poor, caring for the homeless, caring for anybody that needs caring for, what aspect of society, what political genre do you normally associate that with? The left. The left. Yeah. More liberal, more kind of democratic sort of leaning, that sort of emphasis. If you think of the message as taking the message of Jesus and his forgiveness, the forgiveness of sins, his death on the cross, his resurrection to establish life and salvation, and you make that the focus of your mission, what side of the spectrum does that normally become associated with now? With the right, with conservatism. You see, and the tragedy here is that there has been a wedge increasingly driven between these two. So now we have churches that are saying things, or let's put it this way, we have churches on the right, or that are generally more traditional, more conservative in their approach, saying things like caring for the poor, helping the world, all that is really irrelevant. You don't really need to do it. It's just, you know, do it if you want to, and if you don't want to, don't lose any sleep over it. It's the message that matters. And then you have churches on the other side of the spectrum saying the message of Jesus is too exclusive. It doesn't respect other religions. And so we keep that within the confines of our church buildings, if we have it at all. But our work in the world is not to convert, but to help. And those are the two poles now we're functioning with. That's the spectrum. Now, is there a lot in between? Of course. Because generalizations don't mean what? Everyone, okay? Generalizations are generalizations, all right? So there's lots of spectrum, lots of places on the spectrum. Now, as you move across this spectrum, you have a variety of theological ideas that are reflected. And the one we're going to look at today is salvation. Salvation. So let's do a little more experimenting here, or a little more If I take the position that the job of the church is to keep the message of Jesus, however that message is put forth, within the confines of the church building, because other religions are as valid as ours, and the job is to help people, what does that imply about how that church might view salvation, if they view it at all? What were some of the assumptions that are being made there? Or, well, actually, it might be just the opposite. If Christianity is no more, if Islam and Judaism and Buddhism and Shintoism and Taoism and all the other, if they're equivalent to us, just different ways of doing God, then salvation is for who?
Everyone.
Everybody's saved. Everyone is, because we're just, you know, it's like we all go to the same mall, but you head for Neiman Marcus, and Brent heads for the ice cream store, and Steve goes to the buffet, and we all go to different shops, but we're all we're under the same roof. Okay? That's sort of the inherent, unspoken, and oftentimes spoken message on the left, the far left of the church. That religions are equivalent, that if salvation is a question outside of this life, and for many people increasingly it is not an issue, everybody will be saved. Now, if you go to the other side of the spectrum, churches that believe that the message of Christ, the cross and the resurrection, must be brought into the community, shared with people, that the message of his God's love for sinners, and that the fact that people are sinners and need to hear that and know that, is important to bring into the community, what kind of view of salvation does that church imply, that message? Who's saved? Those who hear the gospel. Now, we don't decide who hears the gospel, or we don't decide who is saved. The Holy Spirit works faith. That's what these churches would say. But that God works through the gospel to save is a foundational matter. So the gospel must be shared so that God's work may be done through the gospel. Now today we have, in worldwide Christianity, we have basically these two poles, and then a lot of variations on the theme. Now you've been listening to me preach long enough, you know where I stand on this pole, right? Yeah, of course. And where we as a congregation as a whole, generally, what we believe, that the message needs to be heard. But not to the exclusion of the mission of service. And I think this is where our congregation and others who take the position we do could do a little better job at times. You know, rather than just sort of painting ourselves into a theological corner and waiting for the roof to fall in. You know, we might as well just move into the caves in the desert then, if that's the mentality, right? And not be of any good to anybody. So there's always room for discussion, whatever view we take, in terms of what the implications are, on one side of the spectrum are for the other. Because we're not trying to exclude ourselves for the sake of the other, or our own sake. We want to find some way to function within the whole ministry of the Word and the sacraments, which is, after all, God's giving. And that giving is not excluded to Word and Sacrament. It's also giving through His people in service to the world. That's very much a part of who we are. So today we're going to look at this question then, more specifically, and we have these two pieces to help us do it. On the one, I have already spelled out a little bit of this distinction between mission understandings, and the other one, the more express question, is everybody saved? Is everybody saved? So let's look at this mission piece first, and I'll just read through some of this so it gets on the recording for those who may listen to the CD. And then you can read through, we'll have some discussion, ask questions, make comments, whatever you'd like to do. Beginning at the top of this section here, what many Lutherans say, what is really important is mission. And what the author means here is the mission of service, service to the world. Everything else either has to be helping mission or along, or it is really not important. They do not want to get involved in doctrinal disagreements. Many congregations work this way too. They emphasize helping people. They send people abroad to dig wells, build roads, provide better medical equipment and services. Mission is trump. That is, the mission of service is the main thing. Those Christians who regard mission as what's really important work out of a certain perspectives. All doctrinal disagreements they may have with each other and other church bodies pale in comparison to this kind of mission. Lutheran, Baptist, Catholic, what does it matter? As long as we're doing mission, as long as we're doing service. Differences on doctrine may have their place, but they must not be allowed to sidetrack the mission. This perspective is often supported by the well-known proverb, if you give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. If you teach him how to fish, you feed him for the rest of his life. And I'm all for teaching people how to fish because I come from Minnesota where fishing is very important and virtually a sacrament, not quite, but close. Okay. But what about forever? And here's the question that then we have to take up and consider here in the light of this understanding. Something is topsy-turvy in this approach to mission. Something is upside down here. The person we are reaching out to not only lives for a day, but forever. The important thing is, what happens to forever? Now, here is where a great divide has emerged in the Western world. And it's happened since the Enlightenment. 300 years or so. With the continuing encroachment of rationalism and secularism, a ceiling of meaning has been placed over Western society, the mind of Western man. And that ceiling, when you bump up against it, intellectually, is telling you meaning goes this far and no further. Meaning goes this far and that's where it stops. It stops where you can't see beyond. If you can't see it, if you can't quantify it, if you can't measure it, if you can't add it up and, you know, divide it and subtract it, then it's out of the realm of our concern. And so, in the last three centuries, as the church and its interpretation of reality in the Western world has declined, science and its interpretation of reality has ascended. So now today you turn on your television set and rather than hearing somebody interviewing a pastor about some problem or some social issue which you were a couple generations ago, you would have more almost commonly read about in newspapers and so forth because it was more commonly done. Now when you see television programs dealing with matters of import to life and to the world, who are they usually putting the microphone in front of? A scientist. And the scientist usually speaks in the language of what the old Europeans used to call the royal we, right? Well, we now think that volcanoes operate like this. And I always think to myself, who are we? Well, you see, that's a collective word that means we in the scientific community who by consensus give meaning and substance to these things have agreed, have decided. Well, what's come along in Western life with this decline of the church and the ascendancy of secularism and science has been, because of this ceiling, has been the loss of transcendent meaning. And with the loss of transcendent meaning, the loss of a sense of human beings as created for eternity. Now, you could ask, you know, if we could go out, if I could send you out today, we all went out, and our assignment was we have 2 hours. We're going to go over to Fashion Island or over to South Coast Plaza or go down to the beach and with a microphone and a recorder, and And you're going to ask as many people as you can in the space of 2 hours, do you believe in an afterlife? Okay? Any kind of an afterlife, what's the likelihood you'll get a positive response? Something, maybe. Okay? And then if you were to ask them, do you believe in eternal death? What do you think would happen to the responses? A lot of them? They would probably go down pretty fast. Yeah. Because a generic belief in a kind of spirituality that continues on after death is easy, isn't it? I mean, you can hold that belief and it doesn't really have any consequences. You might not know what that means. In fact, it can mean pretty much whatever you want it to mean, right? You could be a disembodied spirit that just sort of floats up into some other part of the universe and, you know, what does what it does. Or you might become a soul that finds homage and finds room in some other created life someplace and takes up another existence. You might come back as a toad or as a Jimmy Durante or something. Who knows? It could be anything. But the point is, you see, once the lid was put on Western life and it's under the Christian understanding of man created for God and for eternity, either with or without God, once that lid has gone on and that level of meaning is taken away, now, if there's any spirituality of an afterlife, it is completely open to interpretation. It can be anything you want it to mean, or it can be, as some of you would find out with your interviews, it could be nothing. People say, no, this is it. You live and then you die. It's over. That's what my neighbors think next door to me. Over here. This is you live this life, you do the best you can, and then when you die, you just get plowed under, and then you're gone. You cease to exist. You see. Well, that message is increasingly becoming more common. That way of viewing things. So what's at stake here? What's at stake here? Well, let's go on here. What happens? We're in the middle of that first column. What about forever? Now to the next section. Mission, properly understood, is bringing the good news about forever, eternal life in Jesus Christ because of the gospel. Yes, we are also concerned about wells for water and healthy crops and better medicine, food for today. But we dare not and must not put the cart before the horse. When Jesus was dealing with the 5,000, and feeding all these people. And they came back the next day because they said, hey, there's a free lunch here. And what did he say to them, remember? He said, I know why you're back. Because you got fed yesterday. And then he went on to say what? You can paraphrase.
No free lunch.
Why do you seek the bread that perishes? You see, I am the bread of life. Man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. So the message for us as confessional Lutherans that is essential is this one, that the human being is a creature that is destined for eternity, not a generic void in which a disembodied spirit just sort of melds in with the universe. But as a being, as a person, we will continue into eternity in some form, with God or apart from God, just as we do in this life. Just as we do in this life. There are people in this world that live with God, and there are people in this world who live without God. That will continue through death into the resurrected life. Now, this is classic Christian theology. I'm not making anything up here. It's just that when you hear this kind of talk in our setting, in our time, how does it sound? It's jarring, isn't it? It's like, whoa, that might be consequences to my life. You see, well, that's right. We do not claim to be able to say who God chooses to save and who is not saved. That's not our issue. We'll get to that on the next page here. Let me stop here. Any comments or questions or anything you want to add or throw in or as we go along? Okay. The next point here, salvation is at stake. Mission is all important because salvation is at stake. Everything else is secondary. How did we end up putting the cart before the horse? For nearly 20 centuries, the Christian church, whether it was the Orthodoxy, whether it was the early apostolic church or the Catholic church that came about afterwards, the Christian church, in its certainly in its general message, has always proclaimed the message that the Jesus coming was for salvation, not for self-help, not for personal esteem, self-esteem and improvement, but for salvation. That's what's at stake, and that's what we continue to believe. We fell into the trap of assuming everyone is saved, no matter what anyone believes. Now, this is the framework we live in today. When Linda and I were in Europe a couple years ago, we were in Rome, and our hotel was right there by the Pantheon, you know, in the Piazza della Rotonda. And so we were in and out every day, and got to know some of the kind of local folks right around there in little shops. We'd say hi, and you know, we'd stop in and buy some gelato or something. So after about 4 or 5 days, I was in this little shop talking to this guy. I'd seen him several times, and we were kind of chumming around. And so he started asking me about what I do. And so I told him, yeah, Luterano. You know, he's like Italian, you know, Luterano, like, yikes, a heretic, you know, kind of jokingly. So we got a little further into a discussion about Christianity, you know, and he's a Roman Catholic, you know, the Viva la Papa and all that, very devout. And then I started talking about the message and salvation. And as soon as I got to the point of that salvation comes through Christ, through the gospel, through the good news of Jesus, the conversation took a decidedly different turn. It got very chilly all of a sudden. You see, he was a very, by his own words, a very devout Catholic. You know, he went to Mass and, you know, but his view of salvation was thoroughly cultural. You see, his reason was very generous, as it always is. So that everybody was, if there is a salvation afterlife, everybody is included. Nobody's excluded, you see. Well, this is the cultural air we breathe, isn't it, in the West? This is the common currency that we encounter all the time. Europe is quite a bit ahead of us in terms of the kind of the atmosphere of secularism, where the turning the back on the church has been, and after two world wars, it's not hard to understand why. There's been a lot of disillusionment with Christianity in Europe. You know, it isn't just too easy to point to Europeans and say, well, they've all these great church buildings, but nobody's in them. Well, you know, there are historical and sociological reasons for that, not just theological. So it's not so simple just to dismiss all of that out of hand. I wonder what our country would look like if in the last century we had fought two major world wars on our soil. And if one of the administrations that was one of the chief instigators of that war had a lot of support early on from Lutheran churches, which was the state church. And after the debacle and after everything had been destroyed and the country was on its knees, and you get back up and start dusting things off and putting things back together, you step back now in the next generation, you take a look at those churches and you say, what was that all about? What role did they actually play? What did they, you see? So it's not simple to, but in terms of the actual kind of day-to-day retail life in European societies generally, contrasting to ours, they are far more secular. They're ahead of us in that curve. And we're rapidly approaching it. We're moving in that direction very, very quickly. And one of the chief components of this ideology is this idea that if there is any religious salvation, and of course for many people it's not even a question, that all of the religions are equivalent. They're all equivalent. It's just a matter of which which basket, which bucket in the ice cream stand you want to take your flavor out of. You got the Lutheran bucket, you got the Buddhist bucket, the Catholic bucket, the Wiccan bucket, whatever flavor of religion you want, they're all the same. And this is commonly believed today in the West. And of course, it is a direct threat to the Christian message. And at the heart of it is the offense of the church's claim of the uniqueness of Jesus. The uniqueness that is in Jesus Christ. That's the offense. Now let's look at a quote from Luther here. You can read some of this stuff too. From Luther's commentary on Galatians. The truth of the gospel is this, that our righteousness comes by faith alone without the works of the law. The falsification or corruption of this gospel is this, that we are justified by faith, but not without the works of the law. The false apostles preached the gospel, but they did so with this condition attached to it. The scholastics do the same thing in our day. They say that we must believe in Christ and that faith is the foundation of salvation, but they say that this faith does not justify unless it is formed by love. That's very Roman Catholic. This is not the truth of the gospel. It is falsehood and pretense. Human reason has the law as its object. It says to itself, this I have done, this I have not done. Now, the reason this is pertinent, I think, to the article, and when I read this, I wondered why he stuck this on here. But then I start thinking about the appeal to human reason. And what postmodern life is in the context of the Enlightenment and secularism is a vast movement of self-justification. Human beings have taken salvation into their own hands and have reinterpreted it in non-religious terms. So, let's take a look at the culture for a minute. Let's just do this little exercise. Let's think about our society, Western Europe, America, apart from religion, apart from the churches. Just keep religion out of it, okay? It's as if we don't know anything about the churches, all right? What messages from our cultures do we get about what it means to be fulfilled, to be human, to be saved in that sense? What does the culture tell us?
You deserve it.
Okay, there's an assumption that you deserve fulfillment. Okay, and deserving means it somehow it's inherent in you.
If you work for it, you can get it.
That, that's more of a mechanism, more of a means. What are the actual promises in terms of the end game? What is fulfillment? What is salvation in the secular sense?
Success.
Financial. Money. Okay, the bigger the pile, the more fulfillment. What do you see on television, on the internet?
Entertainment. Entertainment.
Entertainment will fulfill you.
Material.
Participating in I believe in music, right? Participating in the experience of music, of entertainment, of in that venue, that in that interaction is fulfillment. Okay, and it isn't that there isn't fulfillment in some of these things. It's partial, but not in a secular culture. Because in a secular culture, people will look in these areas to find life. To find life in its fullness. Okay, what else?
Acquisition.
Yeah, what's one of the most persistent, common themes in Western society? Sex. I mean, we're absolutely drowning in sexuality, right? Wherever you look. One clear message of Western society is to fulfill yourself, you must be a thoroughly sexual being. Satisfy your sexuality at any opportunity. Okay, that's another one. It's financial success, material success. I'm not so sure about vocational success. We're kind of ambiguous about that. I mean, the current state of the economy makes job success a little bit shaky. You know, just having one is probably success, just actually having a job, right? But you see my point. When you remove the transcendent dimension out of life, and then you ask the questions about fulfillment, what does it mean to be human in the fullest sense of the word? You are stuck within a closed system. You have to find fulfillment within the things that are right there around you. Materialism, sexuality, wealth, interpersonal relationships, meaningful relationships, entertainments. And is that look like the Western world? Absolutely. And why is there so much disillusion and cynicism in the Western world? Because it doesn't work. It doesn't deliver. It doesn't deliver. You know, you can, I mean, I don't know, it's almost so hackneyed, you know, it's almost like you're living on cliches when you talk about this stuff, but it's so self-evident, you know, that these things are all provisional and temporary. Is there fulfillment in a certain, is there a certain level of fulfillment in material things? Of course. Yeah. Is there a certain amount of human fulfillment in sexual relations? Yes, naturally. In having a good job? Yes. In being entertained, in participating in some kind of cultural affect that brings enlightenment and artistic appreciation. Yes, all these things can bring certain dimensions of fulfillment. But what happens at the end of the day? You know, the lights go on and you see Woodstock in all its glory. You know, I had some friends who went to Woodstock. I was scheduled to go with a couple of buddies, one guy from San Francisco named Jim Flanagan. He was a really nice Irish kid from West Los Angeles. It was just the nicest kid in the world, and then he got tied up with this band in junior high school. I was in bands too, but his bands went in the psychedelic direction. He moved to San Francisco and he became a complete idiot. We were going to go to Woodstock together, he and I and another guy, and they wound up going. And when they got back, I asked him, you know, gee, I saw it on TV, what was it like? You know, he said it was terrible. It was disgusting. He couldn't say enough bad things about it. He said people were throwing up everywhere. They were having sex all over the mud. He said it was awful. People were sick, and they were hauling people away in ambulances, and they were defecating on the ground. And I said, well, I'm kind of glad I didn't go, you know. But see, what happens when the things we look to for fulfillment, for ultimate fulfillment, are invested with that much expectation, and the lights get turned on, what do we see? They turn on us. Woodstock was the end of the 60s movement because it exposed the bankruptcy of the whole countercultural thing. It was just a big sham, during which a lot of people made a lot of money in the music business. That's about what it amounted to. And a lot of kids lost themselves in drugs and free sex and all kinds of other things that were very destructive for them. So the Christian message comes into a world, a closed system, where people are trying to find themselves within themselves, and a message comes from outside and says, I am going to break into this closed system, this relentless pursuit of self that ends in death, and I'm going to break through and open a door to the future, a real future. So there is an authentic pathway to fulfillment. Now, I'm not talking about some kind of, you know, ultimate self-help program here. We're talking about salvation, because what at all costs are we really looking for in this life, if you think about it? Think about the word salvation, but try to remove it a little bit from its religious context. Doesn't salvation, to be saved, to be delivered, sound like something that a lot of us are looking for in many areas of life? Deliverance from what? Bad debt, from bad relationships, from a bad job, from a lousy place to live, from a terrible political system. And you can pick your party. Bad health, deliverance from this, deliverance from myself, the hardest one of all. You see? And so we look for all, you know, for Western man and woman to think that salvation is no longer an issue, they're looking for it every day. Every day they're looking for it. In all kinds of ways. And the message of the Christian church is that salvation with a capital S, the big salvation, has been accomplished for you by the only one who can do it, the living God. So when Luther talks about the truth of the gospel and the law, seeking salvation through law, we have to do a little theology on it ourselves. And if he were living today, I'm sure he would talk in these terms too. That what this is talking about is that man and woman in the post-Christian world are still seeking self-justification. They're still seeking salvation, deliverance. But now it's apart from religious categories. And so they no longer look to God as the source of their deliverance. They look to one another. And boy, now the trouble really starts. You know. And so I said in the sermon here some weeks ago that everybody is so busy looking for self-fulfillment for themselves, they haven't got time for you. And if that isn't a vicious circle, I don't know what is. Because where do you find fulfillment in this life? Not in the one to come, but where is human fulfillment found most genuinely in this life? It is with others. But when the others are too busy looking elsewhere for it to have time for you, what happens to that cycle? You start chasing your tail. You never get there because the one I really need, you, and the one you really need, me, are not available. Because we're looking for at this, we're looking at that, we're looking here, but we're not finding each other. And this is part of the lostness of contemporary life, the dislocation that's taking place in contemporary life. People are in search for deliverance, for salvation, for fulfillment, and they're looking for it in all kinds of inappropriate places and looking for it in places that simply deliver just the opposite, not life, but death. All right. You have a few more minutes and we'll wrap it up here. Is everybody saved? Salvation is the issue for us. And this is the potent question. And anytime you've got a question here, you know, just jump in. I'm just keep going here unless you interrupt me. And by the way, Meg Madsen wrote this. You know Meg. So you'll recognize her in here when you know her at all. Oprah Winfrey says, yes. Lutheran Walter Bullman, who died here a couple years ago, theologian, said, yes, difficult as it is because I think of it as unfair. I've come to accept God's universal salvation as the final consequence of Jesus' resurrection. And he speaks for many Christian people today who believe that. Do we have God figured out? Is everyone saved in the end? Some Bible verses suggest that everyone is saved. For example, Romans 5:18, one man's acquittal or act of righteousness leads to acquittal in life for all men. Or Romans 11:32, for God has consigned all men to disobedience that he may have mercy on all. If everyone is saved, then there is no need to worry about being lost or damned. No need to worry about sin. It doesn't matter what we do. No need to distinguish law and gospel as Luther did. No need for mission. No need to worry about church. Whatever happens there is not serious because God saves everybody anyway. You see, this is another reason why the question of salvation is not just a matter of fairness or unfairness. It's not just an inconvenient religious truth to be dismissed. If there is no ultimate salvation, that means there is no final judgment. There is no accounting for the meaning of history. And therefore, history means what? Nothing. Nothing. If there is no accounting, nothing. Now, in my sermon this morning, I talked about parents with kids. Good parents are good judges in the sense that they apply wisdom and they apply a sense of moral conduct. They apply a standard of behavior, of action, even a thought if they can, because they want their kids to grow up a certain way. Why do we do that as humans? Well, the theological answer is because we are made in the image of God. Now, a lioness will teach her cubs to hunt, right? And she's good at that. And other animals will teach their offspring to do certain things. What a lioness will not do is teach her cubs to be moral, to judge ethically between this decision or that decision, because they are not created in God's image. The awareness of righteousness is not in the animal kingdom, but it is in us. Why? Because we are important creatures in that respect. So when you see human beings refusing to be judged, refusing to be scrutinized, refusing to be brought under moral scrutiny, refusing to self-limit themselves morally for the sake of the general welfare, you see someone who is subhuman. Someone who is out of control with their lives. And we all do that. We all have done that to one degree or another. So you see, salvation, in its deepest theological sense, brings us into the realm of justice and judgment and righteousness and into the very meaning of history itself, the meaning of life itself. Let me ask you this question. If somebody were to come up to you and ask you, why does your life have any value? I mean, I know you must think it does, but why? What gives you the idea that your life has any value? Is it because you're here? Because your dog likes you? What gives your life value? It's another good question you could ask, you know, during that two-hour interview on the street. What kind of answers do you think you'd get? I mean, really, why does your life have any value beyond the fact that you're here and you're trying to survive? And survival is, the critters try to survive. Instinct drives them to do that. But why is your life of any value beyond them? Because God has placed value on my life. You see, the whole Genesis story of the creation, which Western man has just dismissed as a bunch of religious mythology, which is nonsense to do because it is a deep theological insight into the nature of human beings and creation. The whole flow of the creation narratives is designed in such a way to say that after God had created the natural world and all its aspects and all its affects, he made this creature that stands head and shoulders above them all to share in his conscious, just, and creative image. And Western man has run away from that as fast as he knows how, and in so doing, he has debased himself. And that's why in Western society, there is a mad scramble for meaning and nobody is finding it. Because they are looking to bread alone and not to the Word of God. That's our message. Salvation isn't only about what is to come. Salvation, we see it all the time, salvation begins now. And how does it begin now? As we are brought under the word of law and gospel. Under the like I wrote in that hymn, we've come to you, or that little piece I wrote for the singing after the before the gospel, we've come from all the falsehoods we have heard to hear you. Because your word is truth. And when we hear you speak, Lord, we know we're hearing truth. That frees and saves and opens the future. From all the falsehoods, we've come to your word, to hear your word. So salvation is not just a matter of pie in the sky by and by. It's that too, because I like pie. I'm looking forward to my pie in heaven, whatever it is. But salvation restores us now, you see. When St. Ignatius, I think it was brought He was quite elderly. He was in the 80s. He lived in southern France, today's southern France. He was the pagans had been after him for years, and finally they got him up on charges before the Roman magistrate, and he was condemned to death in the arena there. And as he was being led to the lions, people were howling for his blood. You know, good old paganism. Don't you want to go back to that in a heartbeat? As they were howling for his blood, one of his attendants asked him, "Why don't you just burn the incense and deny Christ, and you can have your life?" And he said, "I have served him all these years, and he has never failed me. Why would I desert him now?" See, he knew salvation. It was a present reality. Why? Because even in the midst of his aging life and his diminishing abilities, the life of God, the life of Christ, was continually restoring him and renewing him with the hope and the promise of salvation in the fullness that would come as it came again and again and again in the living word of promise. And this is why we want people to, you know, to give us a hearing on this business of salvation. We're not only talking about eternity. We are talking about that. It's extremely important. In fact, it's ultimately important in that respect. But as people are in this mad and frantic search for themselves, you know, today, 1 in 10 people are watching the World Cup. I was one of them. Good for the USA, you know. England, they deserved a tie. They didn't deserve to lose, but they did deserve the tie. 1 in 10 people are watching the World Cup. And, of course, having been in Europe a few times, over there, football is... it is a religion for a lot of those people. I mean, it's all those guys, all they talk about. They live for, you see. Well, what we want to say is, as good and as wonderful as some of these things are, there is more. That's what Jesus was saying to the crowds along the Sea of Galilee that day, you know. I know you liked the lunch. It was good, wasn't it? It kept coming. You ate till you were full. But there's more. There's more. And that's what we are fighting for today in the church, in the West, in the confessional movement. And that's why my preaching increasingly is taking on the culture more and more, because we have to recognize that the culture is our opponent, not the church. Eventually, you know, churches will learn to live with each other and find ways to work together, and we're not going to agree theologically on all these matters. That'll come in the kingdom. We'll all be one there. But our real opponent is this death-dealing culture that calls it life and is giving people these rat mazes to run around in that lead them nowhere. So we are fighting for the message of salvation, not because we're trying to bring a negative message of damnation to people, because that's a consequence we don't want to think about. I mean, God will take care of that. That's his business. If that is going to happen, that's his business. But we know the life that we have in Christ. We know the fulfillment that is in him. We know the future that he continually opens for us, and we know that it is the authentic word of life. It's not some false religious lie or some illusion we just crank up to make ourselves feel better. It's a real, authentic word of life. And that's what we want people to know and to be embraced by in this world. And that's why it's so important to confront questions like this. It's not a simple matter of saying, no, not everyone is saved, and if you don't get right with God, you're going to go to hell. That doesn't really help much, does it, to say that? It might be true, but that doesn't put the emphasis where it belongs. When you read through the New Testament, is it fair to say that the New Testament takes eternal death seriously? Yes. Is it fair to say it almost never mentions it? Yes. Isn't that interesting? It's very rarely mentioned. Why? Because it's not the message. Not the message. That's the given. Continue on this course you're born into, and that's where it goes. And that's where it's been going for thousands of years, right? One, from the womb into the grave, from the womb into the grave, from the womb into the grave. We think by now we have that figured out. And then suddenly Jesus walks out of that grave. And now the message is, from the womb to the grave to the throne. home. That's good. Home, the womb to the grave at home. And it starts now. And for those who believe, as many do, that this is the world that is needs to be saved, where fulfillment needs to be realized, well, to them I simply ask the question, well, what about those that don't make it? What about those that don't arrive at that utopian point of nirvana out there in the future when the environment's going to be completely clean, the population will be in perfect balance with all the ecosystems, everyone will be employed, no sickness, you get the picture. It'll be a perfect world down here. What about all the billions that got plowed under before that happened? What happened to them? What, is death going to end? And if death ends, you can say goodbye to the quality of life in this world. Because within a generation, what would happen here? Overpopulation, this place would look like a beehive with no room to move. You see, I mean, when you start pressing these things with people and getting into this conversation, you can start exposing the fallacies and the foolishness of the kind of this worldly salvation and fulfillment that people are banking in. And it's because they have abandoned the sense of their value and importance to a living God. And they place value now on themselves based on what we do, what we're going to do. So that's the point of the discussion about salvation. The final point I want to emphasize from this sheet, and you can read it yourself to get the whole thing, is that we are not in the business of saying who God will usher into the kingdom and who he won't. That is not in our portfolio to discuss. It's above our pay grade, as they say. We don't talk about that. I don't know who's going to be saved, and neither do you. I don't know, ultimately. I know it's going to be a surprise. I do know that. And I suspect, knowing what little about God that I know, that what we're going to be truly astounded at in heaven is who's there, not who's not there. And we're going to find out what grace is all about. If we didn't know here, we're going to find out there. You see. But that's our message, is not to push people to a precipice of such fear and dread like they did in the Middle Ages, where they come flocking into the church just to save their necks. That's not love. That's not graciousness. That's not... This woman who washed Jesus' feet this morning in the gospel lesson didn't do so out of fear that she was going to be damned. She did so out of gratitude and love for the great forgiveness that she had received and the new life that opened for her. It's so important for people to receive forgiveness at the most fundamental level in terms of God's forgiveness in this life, because it opens tomorrow for them. There is no greater power on earth than the forgiveness of sins. And if you've ever been estranged from anyone in your own life because of your own doing, and they have come to you and said, I forgive you, you know what that means. Suddenly, the future opens up, and the weights fall away, and you can start living again. That's what God wants for people. They're not going to find it in their soccer team. Not going to find it in their job. In their bank account. In how many sexual partners they have. In how many cars they've got. In how many guitars they own, sadly speaking. I know Brent and I are very sorry about that, but you see what I'm saying? But they will find it, and it will find them in the Word of Christ, in His gospel. So that, we're talking about mission. That's our mission, you see. To have that deep sense that salvation is at stake, but it's not simply a matter of dangling damnation in front of people and scaring them into the kingdom. It's bearing witness to that new life and fulfillment that begins now. You see, once I was lost, now I'm found. You know, I was blind, now I see. And the New Testament is filled with stories of people whose lives were delivered and in that sense were they received fulfillment because they met Christ. They met Christ and they could begin again. Even the guy on the cross, you know. dying thief hanging there crucified, breathing his last breath. Jesus, when you come into your kingdom, remember me, will you? I don't have many prospects here. And Jesus said what? Today you'll be with me. You see. So that little story always helps me remember that salvation isn't just for this life. You know, even when the last breath is being breathed, that the word of God's promise is right there to meet it. You see. Just as when we throw that last shovel of dirt on our grave, and the grave diggers all leave, Christ shows up and starts unshoveling the grave because he's going to get us out of it. You see, those are the images we live with because of God bringing us continually out of death into life, death into life, death into life, until finally when we die for the last time, we live again. So to bring the message of salvation is to bring a very, to use the more common vernacular, a very positive message of hope. There are consequences, but think of it, as I said, in terms of the importance of judgment and righteousness, that we are creatures that are deserving to be judged, because we're not just animals. You know, this is my last anecdote, and then you'll stop. If you've got a friend who's doing something that's harmful to himself or others, or herself or others, and you confront them and they say, who are you to tell me what to do or get into my business? Your proper response could be, do you think of yourself as so unimportant that you're not worthy to be judged? Are you of such little value to yourself and to others that you think you're not important enough for someone to point out your wrongdoing? For heaven's sake, what do you expect a friend to do? Love can do no, that's like a parent with children. Your son just burned down our house. Oh, that kid. Want some ice cream, Johnny? It's time for supper. Come on in. Have dessert first. After he's burned down the neighbor's house. No, your kid burns down the neighbor's house. What do you do in love? Throw the book at him. Yeah. Because there are consequences for moral creatures to make decisions. You see. So share the good news, bear witness to Christ with that understanding that salvation's at stake, but that salvation is a good thing. It can have dire consequences, but it also, more importantly, brings life. Okay, any comments, questions, discussion, rebuttals, refusals, condemnations?